There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave counsel. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
Yeah. It's always interrogatory that gets us started on Midday Mobile. Glad to have you here on this Tuesday and a couple more hours of live local talk. You know, we do 56 hours a week of live local shows or more, and you can always catch those in podcast form when you go to the FM Talk 106.5 app. That's the first place they post. I wish, like I've told you in the past, I had some Machiavellian way to make that happen, but it just happens that way. You can also then get them on any of the places you subscribe for podcasts. Make sure to subscribe to FM Talk 106.5. And if you're just refusing to do any of the other ways, you can go straight to the website, fmtalk1065.com. Just click on the podcast tab there. All right, coming up in just a minute, and State Senator Chris Elliott joins us, and we've got a lot to talk about with him as they have some time to talk this week because it's the second spring break of this year for the Alabama legislature, and we have some time to look at what's coming up next. Also on the show, Yaffe on the way, and we'll look at this. Some of the notes I made to myself last night and this morning, were, I guess Canada now realizes, you know, Haiti's out of the news, right? Takes the attack in Moscow, kicks barbecue and Haiti out of the news. But I saw a headline here. The Canadians now are going to begin evacuating their citizens from Haiti. Way to get on the ball, Canada. Good job. We'll get to that. And an update on barbecue. We haven't had, you know, I mean, it's just barbecue's out of the news. And you know, I think we need to keep them in the news. Also, a throwback crime story out of Chickasaw. This is retro. A man has been stabbed and robbed for his Jordans. Hey, 1980s, 1990s called. They want their news story back. We'll get to that in just a little bit. And, of course, the story discussed so much since last night and this morning. People watching the video of the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge there in Baltimore, as they call it. And, the latest here, and I imagine we'll continue to get information on this for quite a while. They say if you see the video, you see the construction workers on the bridge. They're counting those people in cars. Initial reports are saying at least a dozen cars went into the water, which they said was 47 degrees, in addition to 20 or so construction workers who were working on the bridge at the time. So I mean, you can, how many people were in each car, we don't know. And those 20 or so construction workers that were pouring concrete on the bridge at the time of the crash. This is a lot to talk about here. As I heard this morning, and once again, I don't claim to have every piece of information, but I did watch the video. That makes me some kind of expert. I don't think so. With the people saying the captain of the ship, and first of all, it's going to be a I guess they call them harbor pilots. Yeah, harbor. We have like the bar pilots, harbor pilots here that take the ships from offshore into the Port of Mobile. Baltimore has the same thing. They have harbor pilots. So first of all, it would be the harbor pilot at that point, I would imagine, running this Singaporean flagged ship, right? So they're doing that. But number two, all the discussion of the pilot, and I'll get in this discussion with State Senator Chris Elliott, actually, because he has a captain's license as well. If the ship loses power, my buddy and I were talking about this morning, that's the job of the engineer, right? The captain can only steer a ship that is under power. So it seems like with the ship losing power, regaining power, you see all that black smoke there, which, I mean, if you have a diesel engine, you have a tractor that's got water in the tank, it's having trouble, you see all the black smoke that comes out of that. there's something wrong with the engines. They're getting them back on and then off again. I don't know what a captain, or in this case, that Harbor pilot, could do with a ship that didn't have any power on it. So we'll talk about that throughout the show as well. And actually, I'll bring that question up to our first guest on Midday Mobile, State Senator Chris Elliott, joining us now. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me on. An interesting news day, for sure.
It is. So we're going to get into what's been going on in Montgomery. But first of all, yeah, you and I just talked. Let's talk about this. So, you know, since last night, we haven't had a lot of time to digest this. But if you go online, people are saying, well, the captain. Well, if a ship has no power, the captain can't do anything about that. To me, and I don't know the whole situation here, but how about the engineer?
Yeah, you're exactly right in your analysis of that. Those of us that are, you know, close to the water and grew up on the coast and watching ships come in and out of the bay and have been around this, you know, find these types of things particularly interesting and probably study them more than folks in the rest of the state or do. But yeah, it looks like, you know, from the videos I've seen this morning that this was a mechanical failure of on the ship. And you're correct, the pilot that is piloting the vessel is really giving instructions to the helmsman at that time. And if the ship loses power, there's very little the pilot can do, or frankly the helmsman can do at that point. I mean, your options are very limited. And coming down the river at that point, you've got two different scenarios. You know, you've got the forward movement of the ship, but you've also got current.
Yeah, you've got the river and the tide, and I don't know how I don't know if they were opposing or lined up at that point. I don't know enough about it there, but yeah, even if you lose all power, I mean, you're going to keep moving.
That's correct, and it looks like two things happen. It looks like they deploy the port anchor, which is one thing you can do without power, right? Mm-hmm. To try to stop the ship. That's going to turn the ship, and it looks like that's exactly what happened. And also, it looks like at some point they regained power for a brief moment, and you saw that plume of black smoke coming out of the stack, which is probably, and I am assuming here, but then trying to reverse the ship. And of course, you know well from fishing offshore and fishing under these are usually single screw vessels.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you reverse any single screw boat, but certainly something of that size, it's going to crab to one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the thrust, the sideward thrust of that torque of that propeller. And so it looks like the combination of the two, the port side anchor being deployed and then throwing the ship in reverse, caused the ship to crab significantly, and that's why you had that turn, if you will, into the bridge pile, which was obviously catastrophic. And our thoughts go out to the folks that clearly are, you know, just were not expecting something like that to happen in their workday.
Yeah, imagine going across those bridges. And of course, there's going to be more time in the future after we deal with the human tragedy of this to talk about the economic tragedy for a port. You know, I think about it, you know, as a Mobilian, thinking about it, you know, what that must mean for Baltimore. You know, that their port shut down. They're not a port now.
You're correct. Port's going to be shut down. The city's going to have serious transportation issues trying to get back and forth. And that's why so many of the bridges we design now, and the Mobile River Bridge will be this way, the bridge over the Intracoastal, the new bridge that Aldott's building right now, have the piles outside of the water, not outside of channel, outside of the water. And so there's not the risk of impact from barge traffic or ship traffic.
Because that thought went through my head. What would that mean in a situation where you have the I-10 Mobile River Bridge, or like you said, the bridge on the ICW, and which would be a big deal on the ICW, but where they're talking about the bridge span for Mobile River Bridge, it would shut down the Port of Mobile.
It would, and of course, I-10 traffic as well, while they assess those piles or try to replace that. And so design of bridges has changed to, you know, mitigate that risk. So we move those piles if possible, and that is possible now with the engineering and the technology we have, but also with the shorter spans. Of course, we're just trying to get across Mobile River there, just trying to get across the Intracoastal. But we can span that now without having piles in the water, which means you don't have to rely on a bumper system, a fender system, and it means that those clear spans are not subject to being impacted by ships or barges.
Just joining us, talking to State Senator Chris Elliott here on Midday Mobile. I want to get to some of the things going on in Montgomery, and we'll just dance around here because you would figure I'd ask you about gambling, which I will first. But I'm going to hit the hardest hitting story coming out of the Senate. Saw the update from Tom Stacey over at Alabama Daily News. The proposal to permit mixed spirits to be sold alongside beer and wine has returned with compromise. Okay, now this is that SB 259, right? That would, I'm clutching my pearls right now, would let me buy alcohol, like what, pre-mixed margaritas and stuff, where I get my Coors Light?
Yeah, so I was thrilled to serve on the RTD, that is a ready-to-drink task force that was created by legislation last year to try to see if we could find a way forward on this legislation, and the task force unfortunately ended up kicking the can down the road, if you will, and so I think what Senator Singleton's trying to do here with his bill is keep that conversation alive, which is wise, but I don't think we'll see necessarily a resolution out of it this year, although I'm hopeful that we can get there. Sean, just like so many things, this comes down to, what is it? Money.
Yeah.
And who's going to be able to play in the game and who can't, and how many products and who's distributing them, et cetera, et cetera. But what we're talking about here is things you may have seen in the ABC store, which is a pre-made gin and tonic, a pre-made vodka tonic, a pre-made Jack and Coke or something like that that's already in a can. And it's those types of products. And the question is, where can you sell them? Who can distribute them? Is it just the state's monopoly at ABC, or is this something that could be sold in grocery stores or other places like that? And so you have conversations around alcohol by volume. You have conversations around, so what percentage of alcohol by volume. You have conversations about who's distributing it, how can it be displayed and advertised, and things of that nature.
Why do I feel like this is Free the Hops 2.0? Remember the battle royale there? Okay. So they're talking about maybe going from 12% alcohol drinks to 8%. Well, 8%, there's some beers that are 8%, aren't there, that we're selling? I mean, why we're arguing this stuff. I mean, why? I do know. But, I mean, the naive person that sets up this question goes, why are we arguing about this stuff?
Well, and so I've challenged the ABC board and their director and staff on a number of occasions where they come out with this public safety argument and say, oh, it's going to be awful if you can buy something of that high percentage of alcohol in a grocery store. I said, what's the percentage by, what's the alcohol by volume of wine? Mm-hmm. And they get real quiet real quick because we sell that in grocery stores. We sell that in convenience stores. And
people aren't drunk in the parking lot. People aren't passed out in the parking lot, when they got their wine walking out. I mean, because that's the pushback. They'll say, well, you do this, so it'd be people drunk in the streets laying around,
Yeah, the argument, it may seem like it's about alcohol by volume. I don't think it really is. About 90% of the products that are made out there now are less than 8%. I think we're having a conversation about 10% of the products, so that's not really a big deal. The bigger deal is, how is this distributed? Do you use the beer distributor method that's already in place? Or does ABC get to continue to sell it in its stores? How's it marketed? How do we provide some protections for consumers in grocery stores where they buy their Coke? Well, is there a Jack and Coke right next to it that looks an awful lot like just a regular Coke? And how do you make
you
sure
put it over
you
with the beer?
Those?
Yeah, just put it over with the alcohol. Put it with the beer. It's separate, and then people know they're buying an alcoholic thing.
Absolutely, and I think those are solutions that need to be worked out. But the big deal is going to be, how's it distributed, and who's making money off of it, and who can play in those spheres. And so that seems to be the hang up so far, and something we're just going to have to continue to work through. It'll get there eventually.
That sounds like a perfect segue into talking about gambling legislation in Alabama. But if you can you hold over the news break, and we'll come back and do that.
Absolutely.
All right. More of our conversation with State Senator Chris Elliott right here on Midday Mobile. Be right back. 343-0106.
Listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
Right, 12:24, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Continue with our guest, State Senator Chris Elliott, which is, I'll point out something too here. Before he was the fixture on the Jeff Poor Show, Senator, I mean, you were on my show, right? I mean, just so people understand that I have some standing here.
Oh, you do. You were first back when I was on the county commission before Jeff was ever in coastal Alabama.
Good. See, so y'all mark that down and note that. A lot of texts come in here too about the ready-to-drink beverages. This one, Jim says, in Georgetown, so adding more to this discussion, said, I heard you say that there's beers with 8% alcohol. Well, Imperial Stouts go as high as 12%. Barley wine, still beers, go as high as 16%, and they're all sold in grocery stores. So some facts to lay into this thing. But like you pointed out, this isn't about the alcohol by volume. It's about the dollars by volume.
That's correct, and your texture there is correct as well. And that's been the argument that I've been making is, whoa, we're already seeing folks use the wine laws and wine statutes to make, you know, the fireball.
Oh, yeah, all the fake fireball stuff. Yeah, you see, like, at the convenience store, the Dollar General, yes.
Yeah, that's got wine in it, so it's not spirit-based. So all our spirit-based laws fall under ABC, and getting them to let loose of that control is a challenge. But as I point out to them, they were created by the legislature, and we will ultimately impose our will on them one way or the other.
All right. Well, thinking about things that may not be clear discussion here, gambling in the state of Alabama. House passes this bill through pretty quickly. It goes to y'all. I know talking to Senator Albritton about it a couple weeks ago, he said, well, we changed a whole bunch in it. It looks like those changes may be, I don't know, my feeling is they're too big for the House to vote it through. What are your thoughts?
Well, I sure hope that's not the case. So the House sent the Senate a bill that was structured very well, but had four main components in it, right? It had a very large enforcement component to get rid of a lot of the illegal gaming that's going on in Alabama. And that was a very big push for the House. Representative Witt, who chairs the Tourism Committee in the House, and Representative Blackshear spent a lot of time and focus and discussion on the illegal gaming that was going on in the state. So it had that component. Then it had a lottery component, okay? That's pretty straightforward. Then it had a sports betting component. And then it had a casino component at specific locations around the state. What the Senate did was say, okay, we see what you've done here. We're okay with 2.5 out of the 4 of those things. So the strong enforcement provision is there. The lottery is there. And parimutuel historic horse racing betting is still there at those existing locations around the state. So it's kind of a half a casino, if you will, not full-fledged table games in Class 3. But it's still there and still allowed to continue on. And then the sports betting's not in there. And so you get into politics real quick with this, Sean, where you say, look, what's going to pass? And what is going to pass is 2.5, you know, things out of the 4 that the House sent. And we're in a spot now where the Senate's passed that bill. It is sent it back to the House. Yes, it is different. But if you look at the vote totals, just 22, there's no wiggle room in the Senate. And so if you want a lottery and you want to get rid of this illegal gaming, the only way right now, probably in this quadrennium and maybe for a while longer, is for the House to really seriously consider is 2.5 out of 4 good enough, and can we concur with what the Senate has? Because if it gets sent back to the Senate, this is not me, and this is not policy. This is more politics and simply counting the votes. If it gets sent back to the Senate with substantial changes to the constitutional amendment, the people won't be able to vote on lottery. We still will have illegal gaming in Alabama, and we'll still have all these uncertainties going on with the parimutuel laws and the constitutional amendments and some of the corruption that's going on with some of that. And we've got an opportunity to fix it. The House really needs to seriously consider concurring and let's get this done and on the ballot for the people.
I talk about it on my list of ridiculousness in Alabama would be the discussion of, oh, well, we're going to do historical horse racing. It's the market. Y'all, come on. The market wants to play a dang slot machine, and the gyrations that they go through to be able to have it. Well, it's horse racing, man. It's historical horse racing.
And it looks like a slot machine.
Yes,
and it feels like a slot machine. It's just what's happening in the box that when the bells and whistles go off and you're betting on a horse race that you don't know anything about. Listen, that's another one of those things that it's not necessarily an expansion, and we were able to pick up votes to get the lottery on the ballot for folks if we did it this way. And so, if you want a lottery, the House needs to concur, and let's get on with this.
Coming right back, more with State Senator Chris Elliott right here on Midday Mobile. News is straight ahead.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 12:35 FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Continuing our conversation with State Senator Chris Elliott. And we're talking about gambling as we went into the news break there. Senator, this question from Matt on the text line said, Senator Elliott the following. Number one, why did you change your vote on gambling from the two previous yes votes you submitted with previous legislation and bills? And number two, what would it take to get you to give Alabamians a chance to vote on gambling in the lottery? That's from Matt.
Okay, so Matt, I've voted yes previously in previous legislative sessions on this legislation, and if you check the rolls, I voted yes this time as well. So I'm not sure about the vote change. In both instances, I have voted yes. So I don't need to change my vote if you're wanting me to get something on the ballot for you because I voted yes both times. What I have been trying to do this legislative session is figure out a way to get the Senate to enough votes to pass, and that meant paring down the bill. You had Todd Stacey on yesterday, mm-hmm. and he really did a good job laying out the changes that have happened in the Senate since the last quadrennium. So there are different senators there, and many of them used to be, those seats used to be occupied by folks that voted yes, and this time they are occupied by folks that voted no. And so there's just been a change in the Senate, which means the bills have had to change some in order to get across the finish line and get us to a place where we can put lottery on the ballot. We just need to be careful that that folks don't get too greedy and try to do too much because it will collapse under its own weight and it will lose the support it has in the Senate if you add anything more to what the Senate passed. It just will not work. The worst thing for this bill's success would be the Senate non-concurring, going to conference, and coming out with a different solution, which is 95% doomed if they go that route.
Do you feel any influence from the executive branch on this? Because I think it was last year. I think I played the clip many times when Governor Ivey came out and said she was disappointed that they didn't tackle gambling. And I was like, I didn't hear anything from you. This year, she did throw it in her State of the State speech and seems to be more involved. Any pressure coming from the executive to get something done?
There's not. And the governor seems to be taking the kind of a hands-off approach, saying, listen, we're going to let the legislative process work its way out and see what happens. But no, I don't feel that the governor's office is involved in these discussions at this time.
All right. Switch to your bill here, one of the bills. So this is... I feel like you and I've been talking about this off and on for years, the subject, not the specific bill, and that's occupational licensing. And this bill that you're bringing to what is it? First of all, I guess explain to people who have not followed along about the Office of Occupational and Professional Licensing, how that works and what changes you're talking about making. Kind of first tell us what the thing is and then what changes need to be made.
Yeah, a big topic. Over 23% of all Alabama workers are covered by some occupational license. And in Alabama, we do it very inefficiently and very differently than other states around us, like Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, Virginia in particular, that kind of have this clearinghouse for these occupational licensing boards. Well, in Alabama, we have silos. Each little board is its own state agency, essentially, whether it has one employee or 20 or 40, and they have their own enforcement personnel and their own state cars and their own conference tables in their own buildings, and you can see how that is inherently inefficient. Well, those inefficiencies get passed along to the licensees, and so it turns into a tax to go ply your trade so that these folks, these independent little bureaucracies, can operate and protect their little turf. And then you further run into problems with some of these folks that don't have enough license revenue. They're such a small, occupation that they end up contracting out with these private firms who sometimes are also lobbyists. Love how the lobbyists figured out a way to make some money off of this. And so what happens is really you have these private folks acting as an agent of the state but doing so very poorly. And so you end up with all these audit findings. You have problems with where they're spending the money, how they're spending the money, how they're accounting for the money, what they're telling the board they can't do. It is just an absolute mess. And what I'm trying to do is unravel that, make it much more straightforward, make it much more friendly for business owners and small business owners. These are usually mom-and-pop shops, you know, a small plumbing company, a small electrical company, an auctioneering company, something like that, to just make this easier and more business-friendly than what we've got right now.
So what does it look like? Is it, you said those individual silos, it would all be under one thing for licensing? Yeah. This would be the licensing board for everything, no matter what your profession is.
That's correct. So you look at Virginia has the Department of Professional and Occupational Regulation. You look at Florida has DPBR, the Department of Business and Professional Regulation. And it's like it's one website. Instead of having 64 different websites, we have one website. It's a drop-down menu, and it says, hey, I'm an auctioneer. You click on that, and there's the path for auctioneers. But you don't have this huge bureaucracy of an auctioneer board that has its own building, its own, and I'm using that as an example, but it streamlines all of this under one governmental entity that can handle that. But these private folks that are running these things are just as much a problem. We had one of them that threw a tantrum because he didn't get an automatic increase in his contract. And so Shawnee turned the administrative functions of the massage therapy board off, turned the website off, quit accepting licenses and everything like that. He's holding it hostage. And we can't have that kind of thing operating in the state of Alabama. We just got to clean that mess up.
I mean, and so this doesn't, it's streamlining this and consolidating this. It doesn't go back to the conversation we've had many times about what things should have occupational licenses in the state, right? The old interior decorator argument.
Yep.
Where, they at one point, I think that's changed, but at one point you had to have a license to be interior decorator. I think you don't have to have that now, but interior design you do. Does this challenge that, or this just says you're just going to consolidate right now and, it's not challenging what things have to have occupational license?
Yeah, so removing those silos will help with challenging whether or not we need to have the licenses, because right now it's a turf battle, right? Each individual silo has its staff and its own little board and everything. If we start commingling staff and getting those numbers down some, and everybody's not having their own little turf battle, then we can start having serious conversations about whether or not we need to be licensing this occupation or not. And they are still reviewed under my legislation by the Sunset Committee, which is charged with doing just that, looking at these licensure boards and saying, hey, do we really need to continue this? Do we really need the licensed wrestlers?
What?
Oh, yeah.
What, wrestlers have to be licensed?
Yep. By the state of Alabama, you got to be licensed to wrestle.
So, I mean, you're talking about not wrestling or wrestler. Like, if we're going to go do they call him the senator hailing from Josephine, Chris Elliott, and the Mobile Kid, Sean Sullivan, are going to do our smashing chairs over each other's head or whatever. We got to be licensed.
Got to be licensed in the state of Alabama. So, and I'm not exactly sure the difference between wrestling and wrestling. I think that's a whole lot like the difference between naked and naked. But I'm not exactly sure how that works, but I do know it requires a license, and there's a whole board set up to do just that.
Wow. Learn new things all the time. Get a couple things here that the ballot harvesting bill, what has happened on that, your feelings on that, where you are, and do you think it's needed, and do you think we've had the best bill possible for this in Alabama?
It's sorely needed, and it's sorely needed before the congressional election in Congressional District 2. Terry Latham filled in for Jeff a couple of weeks ago, and I remember Terry Latham when she was the chairman of the Republican Party in Mobile, sending a much, much younger Chris Elliott to do some poll watching in the Black Belt. And some of the things I saw up there were really scary. I mean, you just had outright cheating going on. And so,
what did that look like?
So it looked like giving somebody a whole lot of help filling out their ballot. You know, I don't know who to vote for, but here I am, and let me help you, Miss So-and-so, and we're going to fill this ballot out for you. And that just happened on a scale that I'd never seen before. And so what you've seen is some entities really abuse the absentee ballot process and end up in a situation where they are applying for, filling out, these ballots on behalf of someone else with or without their knowledge and are making a bunch of money doing it. And if you start looking around at some of these races, you get a couple of people doing that, a couple hundred votes at a time, you can swing a race with that and certainly impact it. And so we needed to get a handle on that, and I am glad that we have done that. The folks that say, oh, that's not a problem and y'all are making a problem out of nothing are either in it and making something off of it or not paying attention, because it was absolutely happening in Alabama, and I'm glad we're not doing that anymore.
What are the teeth on this going to be? Because I had read some of this. Could it be a felony here? And then who enforces that? Like, who makes the charge? How does it go through the judicial system?
Yeah, so, it's the district attorneys. It's a felony, but you can believe you're going to have probate judges who are election officials watching for this type of thing. You're going to have the Secretary of State's office involved in it, but it's a felony, and there are significant financial penalties that go along with it. And I can assure you that this Secretary of State's going to be watching it really tightly and take these types of issues when they pop up, very seriously. I'll be honest with you, from what I've seen in the past, and the stakes are high, I think that you will see some prosecutions under this legislation. You're going to see folks continue to try to do this, and you're going to see a Secretary of State and some local officials and certainly the aggrieved party very intent on making sure this doesn't occur.
Yeah, this question from Lori, this is jumping to the next subject here, but it said, can we pass a law requiring anyone who votes on a law regarding education to first substitute teacher for a minimum of 10 days in the bottom percentile, formerly known as failing schools? But that, I mean, that brings us up to this ESA discussion, the ESA. What do you think on this?
Well, as terrifying as it is, we can pass a law that says anything. Yes is the answer to that. I think I understand where she's coming from, and I certainly understand the challenges that our teachers are facing. Most of the educators that I've talked to about our school choice bill are excited about it, frankly, because they've got students that they know are not excelling under the current circumstances for whatever the reason, and may or may not be a distraction to teaching the other students. And so if there's an option for this particular child to get out of whatever situation they're in, whether it's a bad social situation that's involving some bullying, or you've got a kid who's just super smart and just blowing the doors off of the class and is bored and is acting out because of that, to have the ability to put that kid in a different situation where they can, where they can be matched with what their potential is. Most teachers are seeing this as yet another tool in their toolbox to help individual children. It's not a slap against teachers, or public schools at all. It's just an option for parents and families to do what's best for their kids.
Okay, let me throw. I asked Todd about this a couple times, probably for 3 weeks in a row or more. The question about the money, and so it's $100 million, right, that's set aside. I think.
Correct.
Is that okay? So $100 million set aside, and the to for the first 3 years or whatever, the cap on it is, I think, three times the poverty rate, right? Which puts it up to $90,000+, right?
I mean, that's just, correct.
There's a whole bunch of families in Alabama. It's not just people thinking, oh, well, there's just a small number of families that would qualify for this in the first 3 years. I just wonder if the math is there. If you look at the number of families that could qualify this for this, either, you know, a couple or a single parent that would fall in this range of three times the federal poverty rate, they could ask for the 7,000. If you multiply 7,000 times the number of students, is 100 million enough? And what is it, like a derby? Does it open on a, you know, Sunday night? You got to put in there, and then, you know, when the last person's in, everybody else has to wait for next year. Do you know how that works?
So the goal there was to make sure that we didn't crash an education budget, right? If you open the doors wide open and say everybody can apply on day one, there was the very real concern that we cause, you know, some serious harm to the education budget and to public education as a whole, and nobody really wanted to do that. And so this is, like so many things in Alabama, a very incremental approach, right? Let's try this and let's see how this works. Let's see how many folks are takers and how many are not. We may expect everybody to get involved in it, but at the same time, we may expect that a lot of folks stay in the same spot that they're in. Listen, I graduated from private school. Okay, my kids go to public school. They're getting a great education. If I'm eligible for this, I'm not moving my kids. I think where they are is great, and most folks in Baldwin County in particular are in a good spot. I'm not sure there's going to be this mass exodus from public schools that everybody is worried about. And those income caps are for the first 3 years, and then they go away after that. But the reason those are there is to give some peace of mind that we're not going to get ourselves in a situation where we crash the education trust fund budget right out of the gate.
But, you know, I look at it this way, though. You know, let's talk about it in 3 years or now, depending on income. I got kids in that same private school you talked about, right? Why wouldn't I take the $7,000 per child? I mean,
You would. And so that's an option, too. And listen, that's one of the reasons that I was supportive of this bill is, eventually, it gets to a place where your parents and my parents, you know, we didn't have that option, and so they paid full rate. But you will, regardless of income, eventually be able, to take part in that. And listen, I would fully expect you to do so. And you've been carrying a lot of that weight for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now you can use those state tax dollars to educate your child just like you otherwise would have. So we may need to increase the money going into that. This is a start, and I think everybody realizes that it is just a start. Even the detractors certainly realize it is just a start. I don't think they necessarily had a firm opposition to this as it is written, but they are worried rather about the fact that it may grow, and I think that's a valid concern from them.
All right, just a few minutes left, but I got to get your perspective as a senator, and maybe talking to other senators. I had Representative Matt Simpson on yesterday talking about what he will bring to the House floor next week. The ethics reform bill, the ethics bill, and it was interesting. I've been watching it, how he's been impugned by Whitmire and others over at AL.com. They almost make the argument for it in their attack on him, but we don't have time for that. Your thoughts on this, the changes that are proposed? Have you seen the bill, or have you seen the kind of the ideas behind the bill?
Well, first of all, God bless him for attempting it. I mean, I think I've got troubles with occupational licensing reform and getting people mm-hmm. to focus on that. This is something that is a scary, you know, third rail of Alabama politics. And so, I give him, you know, a lot of credit for even attempting, to deal with the issue, which needs to be dealt with. I have seen a draft of the bill. I've looked through it, but it kept changing in the House. So I kind of put it aside. I'm going to wait until he gets it through the House. And then obviously we'll need to focus on it in earnest. But our ethics laws are a mess. And just like we talked about with school choice, it should be expected that we come back and look at them from time to time and say, hey, is this working? Is this not working? Now, this whole business from Whitmire and others that are, yeah. you know, talking about all these folks being corrupt, and, you know, that's unfair. they're part of the problem when they start, you know, talking like that. And that's one of the reasons people hate politics, is you can't have an honest conversation about what's really going on. So shame on them for doing that. Let's have a real conversation about what the problems are and what the problems aren't. And let's have a real conversation about, hey, should legislators be able to, you know, receive a gift or not? I don't care. That's not something that has ever influenced me one way or the other. But what does is, what kind of work can a legislator do or a public official do, you know, outside of their duties at their office? Because, you know, we're part-time from a legislative standpoint. You know, what are we allowed to do the rest of the time? You know, can we have another job? What kind of other job can we have? What can it do? What can it not do? There are a lot of folks that don't stay in the legislature because our ethics laws are so screwed up. And then Representative Simpson's got a point about how broad this is, how arbitrary this can be.
That's
and
my
how
thing.
You can
the arbitrary yep. part, that it should be. And the opinions on something aren't published, right? It should be that I could go, if I'm thinking about doing whatever it is, and I go and looked and say, oh, well, when Senator Elliott asked about this, this was the response from the Ethics Commission. So now I know, I just want things to be equal. What's the rule of law? What's the rule? It applies to, it should apply to everybody equally.
Exactly. And is that ethics opinion? Is it binding on the district attorney? Is it binding on the attorney general? See, that's the problem, is you can get a ruling from one that doesn't necessarily isn't something that the other has to live up to. Who's the prosecuting authority? If the attorney general says this is okay, that's one thing, but the ethics commission may not. There needs to be clearly delineated lines. Who's responsible for this? If I get permission here or get told no here, that needs to stick, and it needs to stick across the board. And so those types of things will prevent the gotcha-type moments, or really the confusion, not just with legislators or other public officials, but with the enforcement folks themselves. Of course, it's clearly a mess because you've got the Ethics Commission and the Attorney General involved in a lawsuit right now. You've had all kinds of problems where the enforcement folks on ethics are fighting with each other over ethics. And so it's out of control. It needs to be dealt with. Whether or not we get to it this session, I don't know, but I will give Matt a lot of credit for at least trying to start the conversation.
All right, Senator Chris Elliott, I appreciate you being on with us today, and we'll have to do this again real soon.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
All right, there he goes. We're coming right back. More Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
Right, 12:56, FM Talk 106.5 in Midday Mobile. Yaffe joining me in just about 8-9 minutes here on the show in the next hour. How many of these texts can we get to here? This one from Adam said, Sean, I really appreciate how Chris keeps in touch with his constituents and how proactive he is in the Senate, but what's up with our Mobile senators? I have heard of David Sessions, but know absolutely nothing about him. As far as the other, I had to go online to find out. Our other is Jack Williams. Okay, so I will say this. Senator Sessions, David Sessions, will be on with Jeff from time to time. I'd like to get him on, too. I've stopped by their fruit stand and bought some stuff about a week ago. Yeah, so I'd like to get him on, but he'll come on with Jeff. And if Jack Williams has been on with me in the past, maybe, but it's not very often. Listen, here's the thing, Adam. There are some elected officials that will do a lot of shows, or some shows, or go on with specific people, and some that really do very little of it. And I think, you know, obviously, I got a dog in the hunt, you know, that I think they all should. But it actually works out well. I mean, it's just like when the sheriffs come in and police chiefs and all that and take questions. I think it just is better. It's better for the community, better for them. So, yeah. But I know that Sessions has been on with Jeff. I'd like to get him back on. I don't know if Jack's been on with either of us ever. So we'll keep working on that. How about I put it that way, Adam? We'll keep working on it. All right. 12:58. Coming right back. More Midday Mobile right here at FM Talk 106.5.